Station number 16716, Canon Gervais, Graham, Reel, Markham, Reel 3.
Canon Markham, Reel 3. You were saying that you decided that you ought to do something with the services at the time of the war. What date did you actually make the step?
This was in the spring of 1940 when I approached the, I suppose, the ACG, Assistant Chaplain General at York, and I had to go and see him, and I just, in fact, the last night been reading my diary of those days, and I noted I was that he was a very large and friendly man. The first question he asked me was, have you got any colours? And I couldn't think what he meant by this till I realised he was meaning, did I play games well? I thought that was a funny way. The first thing that was required on me as an army chaplain, and I made a note in my diary. Later on, he apologized for putting that as the first question. But after that, I was accepted as a chaplain. I had to rush off. I went to Newcastle to buy my uniform, and in a few weeks later, I was bidden to report at York. So I marched off in my army service dress, and then I realized I was grateful for my OTC training because I knew how to salute. First time I walked down the street in uniform. And,
you were expected to buy your own uniform, were you?
Yes, indeed.
What exactly did you buy?
What did I buy? Oh, a tunic and an ordinary service dress. You didn't wear a Sam Brown, but you wore a cloth belt, a cap with had a black strap instead of a brown one. You had black buttons instead of brass ones, so you didn't have to polish anything. But this was the ordinary service dress. There wasn't battle dress in those days.
And you'd wear your collar,
I wear a dog collar with a service dress, yes. Mm. And so I was first posted to a railway training centre in Derbyshire. And I went there and found it was a big field with bell tents in it, and the unit consisted of railway men who were learning how to work railways according to the military model. There was a retired colonel, a nice derrel man, who'd just been dug out to look after this unit, and a few officers there who were, I suppose, engineers of one sort and another. There wasn't very much to do that I could see except shunting trains in the siding somewhere or other. And I learnt to live in a bell tent with my kit, and then as a chaplain, I was just part of the unit without any specific functions that I could see, except to get to know people and to do a bit of social work with their families. And liaison with the local neighborhood. Colonel sent me to interview one or two families in the neighborhood who were thought to be possibly the red light people of the district. But suddenly, out of the blue, train loads, bus loads of men appeared straight back from Dunkirk. Who were unloaded onto us, and they had come unshaven and unshorn unwashed, unfed, straight from the beaches of Dunkirk, where they had been ferried across, put on the nearest train, sent off, didn't matter where, as long as they got away to somewhere else in England. And these men turned up at our camp, and we had to look after them and get them washed and fed and put on the end of a telephone so they could ring up their families and say that they were there and so on. And for two or three days they were in our camp until they could be sorted out and sent to wherever it was they had to go. It was the first sort of main crisis of the war that I was at all involved in.
Were these mixed regiments, all mixed up?
Absolutely. They were just people who'd come off the beaches, got into the nearest boat that they could find, got landed in England, Dover or somewhere, and were put straight into the nearest train, go off like that, and they were all dispersed all over England. Some of them had still got their weapons, their arms, sidearms with them, but they had been hiding in the sand on Dunkirk Beach so as not to be strafed by airplanes, so they'd buried themselves in the sand. They had waded through salt water to get into a boat. Their arms, therefore, were quite unusable. They tried hard to clean them up. But this was a situation the British Army was in those days after Dunkirk.
Did they pose any particular responsibilities for yourself? If they would be in quite a state, no doubt.
They were all in a complete state, yes, poor things. Remarkably cheerful. In fact, only last night I was reading my diary of them. It might actually be rather interesting. I'll see if I can find the exact place I made a description. This is an extract from a diary I kept at the time, Friday, May the 31st. In the middle of dinner, my first real contact with the war began. 650 men and 40 officers from the BEF in Belgium and France arrived in relays of buses from Derby. They were all dirty and unshaven and blear-eyed and ragged. They had not slept for 3 days and nights. They had not seen a bed for weeks. For a fortnight they had marched and fought and marched and fought, retreating to the Belgian coast. All the time they had been shelled and bombed and machine-gunned from the air, ruthlessly and unceasingly. They had not seen any of our own aeroplanes answering back. Supplies and communications had broken down. They had not had a square meal for a week. They had lived on biscuits and bully and what they could find in deserted houses. Quote, "We have lived on what we could pick up from the gutter and that we had to share," someone said. When they got to the coast, they found an empty line of sand dunes, and thousands of them waited on the beach under continuous bombardment from unopposed German planes. Without food or water, they waited there while ships of all kinds came as close inshore as they could and took them off. They waded into the water to the boats. Some who had never swum in their lives swam for their lives that day. They left lines of their dead along the shore, and when they were aboard, there were torpedoes and bombs to encounter still. But those that came through were put into the nearest train at Dover and were rushed off all over England to any place that could provide for them. In Derby, they were given a meal and a drink. They arrived at Weston, our camp, in relays of buses, dirty, blear-eyed and ragged, and in some cases still wet to the skin. Yet they were not a beaten army. They spoke of the hell they had been through, but they all said they wanted to go back and have another try. They laughed and smiled and joked in hoarse voices, and they knew that man for man they had beaten the Jerry. If only they had had airplanes to beat off the air attack, they could have held the enemy. They spoke of the waves of German infantry attacking in masses and how they mowed them down as they came. But as line upon line fell, the advancing Germans climbed over their dead to be shot down themselves, till our gunners were sickened at the sight and, quote, spewed their guts out till they could fire no more. We took them to tents, and they crowed with laughter to see beds ready made, three new blankets and a palliasse on the floor. they tumbled in and lay on the beds, ten to a tent, with cheerful obscenity struggling out of their filthy equipment. Our men came to the rescue, provided them with soap and razors and towels. We led them to hot showers. They reveled in getting clean. We took them to the YMCA and the NAFI, treated them to tea and buns and beer and cigarettes. And in the gathering darkness, we sat in groups on the grass and heard their tales and wondered how we could have done so well.
Do you recall any coming to you for personal help?
No. The personal help was really in getting through to their families. I don't recall being much involved in any personal difficulty in that kind, but I know that on the Sunday, the next day, I had to take a service for them. It was entirely different from what I had expected to do, and it was one of the great challenges, I remember, of my ministry, of what on earth one could say to men in that condition on a Sunday morning service. But within two or three days, of course, they'd all gone and split up again. I've got more details, but you don't want me to read my diary book.
There was a regular Sunday service in any particular unit that you were with?
Yes. Sometimes it was a parade service. Sometimes it was... occasionally, I read in my diary, the colonel said, let's have a real spit and polish one this Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so this was done. Otherwise, in fact, in our camp at Weston, there was a lovely little medieval church only 100 yards away in the next field belonging to the village. And we used this as a place for taking services on Sunday with the cooperation of the local vicar, who was very glad to have other people coming in. We arranged choir practices for the men and services on Sunday. Not very many came, but occasionally we had a parade service when the colonel said it's very good for us to be properly marshalled and all cleaned up and be on parade for the service. He was an old timer, you see, our colonel, and it was regarded as being something that one did in the army. There wasn't much objection at that time.
What happened to the other denominations?
Oh.
Did they all come to you, or were they split?
I can't remember in that particular case there was probably I don't remember a Roman Catholic, there may be a nonconformist padre as well, but I have no memories of him.
I forgot to ask you, what rank did you start with?
I'm one who spent the whole war at the same rank, who has never got promoted. No, you had the acting rank of a captain. You wore three pips on your shoulder, but you were not addressed as, well, some people addressed you as Captain Markham, but you were often referred to by the strange word Padre, Padre Markham. You were an officer in the sense that you were fed in the officer's mess, you were part of the, but you didn't command men. It was like the naval chaplain's tradition, that the chaplain is second in rank to whoever is the senior person present. if there's the admiral present, he comes next to the admiral. If there's only a bosun present, he comes next to the bosun. He doesn't issue orders to people. Mm-hmm. He's friend and companion of all on board. And so with an army chaplain, I never found that having pips and being an officer was made it difficult. It meant you had a status and people knew what your status was, and you knew people saluted you and you saluted senior officers. It didn't stop you being a clergyman. You were a clergyman in uniform, and you would drink in the sergeant's mess or in the naffy, and just as you would a clergyman in a working men's canteen. They might moderate their language when they knew that you were there, but apart from that, you were on equal terms with anybody with whom you met, according to your own personality and the way in which you carried yourself.
Yeah. How long were you at Weston?
Weston till several months in the summer, till I felt really I didn't want to spend the war in a muddy field in Derbyshire. I asked if I could go abroad. So I was posted to number 2 Casualty Clearing Station, which was at outside Rotherham. And I turned up there in November of 1940 to find there was a unit in an empty manufacturer's mansion in the outskirts of the town, consisted of a colonel and 8 doctors and 3 chaplains and 100 men who were orderlies, stretcher bearers, and so on, a purely medical unit. There we had a Roman Catholic chaplain and a Methodist chaplain and myself, and these doctors and surgeons who all come out of civil life, and the colonel, who again was an old stager, who did very little but drink gin most of the time. But when I got there, I reported to him. He said, right, 24 hours notice to move. Go and get your tropical kit. So off I went to a shop somewhere and bought a tropical kit with a magnificent pith helmet, and came back and he said, right, no leave for any of the unit. We are here at 24 hours notice to move. So it was an empty house. There was no furniture to speak of. The kit, the equipment of the unit, had all packed. Was all packed up in packing cases. We're wearing a tropical kit, ready to move. It was October by then, and there was nothing to do except to wait. We couldn't even go on a 24 hours leave, and there was no drill, there were no patients to look after. We learnt to play chess. But we waited there, getting colder and colder, and it became a very snowy winter. And we stayed all through the winter in this empty house, waiting 24 hours notice to move. We could see the bombs dropping on Sheffield. We could see the Blitz going on in different towns. No bombs actually dropped on us. We were outside the town, but it was during the worst bombings. We could see it in other places around. And we waited there. We had right marches just to keep us occupied, but there was nothing whatever we could do. So then Sunday in the spring, get into a train tomorrow morning, and off we went. Got into a train, and there we found next morning we were at Liverpool, and we were on the docks, and there was a huge ship waiting for us to get on board, and we all trooped onto this liner, and found we were part of about 15,000 people, I suppose, on this liner, which had just come from Australia and was full of the most wonderful food that you could imagine. And we had marvelous meals. First time in a rationed, living on bully beef and biscuits for all through the winter. Suddenly there was this spread of food. But of course it was intensely crowded. To every cabin there were 4 or 5 officers in bunks, you see. And the men were crowded on all the mess decks. But we got on board, and then there we were in the Mersey. My goodness, what happens if there's an air raid on Liverpool tonight? and one couldn't tell. Liverpool was being raided from time to time, and I remember we sat there for 3 days and three nights in the Mersey, knowing that if a bomb dropped from Liverpool that night and came on our ship, that was the end of the whole lot of us. There was nothing whatever we could do. But we were very thankful when we sailed down the Mersey out into the Irish Sea, and were thankful to see it was a convoy of a good many ships of different kinds, escorted by destroyers. And then we came around the north of Ireland. We could see a cruiser in the distance, but we realized, we didn't know where we were going, because nobody would tell you that sort of thing, but we were heading out into the Atlantic, and we knew that there were innumerable U-boats waiting to catch us. So we had, of course, boat drill. I carried with me in my pocket, I remember, a little pocket compass and a brass flask of brandy and a slab of chocolate, which I was never separated from. I thought, if I have to get into a lifeboat, at least I have something in my pocket when I get there. We zigzagged about all over the Atlantic, the whole convoy zigzagging. We thought, how extraordinary is, how does he know when he's going to turn, where he's going to go? No U-boat, as far as we know, attacked us, but we couldn't tell where we were going till about a week or two later, we suddenly found we were putting into Freetown in West Africa. It was only after the war that we learnt that, in fact, these zigzags were all premeditated and calculated, because there had been this incredible discovery of the way in which the German signals were being, Enigma it was called, wasn't it? They could decode the German U-boat signals and know where the U-boats were, and the government could pass the message to the commander of the convoy, who would then negotiate to get round the U-boat packs. But nobody could disclose the fact that we knew where the U-boats were, because that would disclose the fact that we could decode the. So it was all a game of enormous bluff, and we were entirely ignorant of what was going on in the higher flights above us, but we were thankful when we got to Freetown. Then we went on round South Africa, had a wonderful time.
Come in there? What are your memories of the voyage itself? Were the activities you were doing on boat?
That's a good question. Well, the ship was, of course, extremely crowded. There was no spare place anywhere. As a chaplain, there were several chaplains on board, of course. We conducted services on Sundays in any place we could find, usually on the open deck. Apart from doing that, we were as much responsible as anybody for organizing education and entertainment on the ship. We had innumerable quizzes and concerts and music. We got choirs together, male voice choirs, of course, the difficulty being that we had no music, had to do everything by heart. But of course, there were many talented people in this. It's a great crowd of men. And there were talented musicians, there were talented actors, there were talented educationists, so that it was one's job to try and identify these people. We had, scouts and tokage, anybody who'd been a member of a scout troop. We had a scout campfire one night. We were singing the old scout songs, you know. And the Tok-H people got together, and the job of the chaplains was to keep the men's minds occupied as far as possible during the voyage.
It mustn't have been very pleasant for the men crowded into their
decks. I don't know. Of course, during in the tropics, it was very hot down in the bottom layers of the ship, which we went, of course, to visit. But with such crowded conditions, it was almost impossible to have much personal contact, well, private talking with people. But I can't remember any individual instances. Anything else you'd like to ask about the voyage?
When you got to Freetown, did you get ashore?
Oh, no. No. We were... Remember, these huge ships were parked in a very narrow little harbour, and we couldn't stay there long because... if you could imagine the effluent from crowded troop ships in a narrow hum, we couldn't swim overboard, for example. In 2 or 3 days, the place became a sewer, and we had to sail away again. We must have polluted Freetown enormously, if you can think of it. Yeah.
Did the natives come out to the boat selling their wares? And
a little bit, yes. But that wasn't... I don't think there was much contact with the Africans at Freetown. It was quite different when we got to Cape Town.
Had you crossed the equator by then?
We'd crossed the equator.
Was the usual
Yes, the ship's crew did the usual tricks of crossing the equator, which obviously some people got involved in. I don't remember taking any particular part in it myself. None of us, I suppose, had ever crossed the equator before, but the proper routine was followed by... But it's the ship's crew who do that sort of thing rather than the troops on board. Yeah.
And then you reached Durban, you say?
It was Cape Town.
Cape Town. What happened there?
There, the reception was quite different. There we were allowed to go ashore, and the people of Cape Town were extraordinarily hospitable, because they knew that a good many of the South African peoples were in fact opposed to the British and were sympathizing with the Germans. Those who were sympathizing with the British went out of their way to entertain these British troops who came aboard. I remember the first, we were up at the quay, so it was quite easy to get off onto the shore, and I, with a friend who was a doctor, I think, we just went for a walk up the main street, and a charming lady said, excuse me, are you doing anything today? And we said, no. She said, well, would you like to come to our country club? So off we went, and we were entertained by the English country club. And the next day there was a wonderful dance with all the local girls came. This was where the officers were treated anyway. She could see we were in officers' uniform. And the men had similar experiences of being welcomed by the people of Cape Town. My memories, of course, were of the way that I in particular was treated, which was of unbounded hospitality for about 3 days from complete strangers who just welcomed us and made us feel at home.
You say you were there 3 days?
Yes, about 3 days in Cape Town.
Had you any idea at this moment in time where you were going?
Oh, no, you never knew that.
I still hadn't told you.
No. We sailed up the... east coast of Africa, and came through the Red Sea, and were all put out onto the shores of Egypt into an awful transit camp, which this was our first sort of Middle East experience, complete dusty camp with just canvas. and there were no other facilities at all. We didn't know what our future was going to be. We just had to wait there for a few days until we were finally put into trains and then taken up to another camp up on the shores of the Mediterranean.